So tonight, what I want to talk about is, of course, the last two of the 10 paramis, loving kindness and equanimity. Another very natural pair in this sets of pairs. And I like to look at these last two as both somehow the end point, the result of all the practice involved in the first eight. And also things that in and of themselves are things we have to practice. There's sort of this interesting combination of both, a result and a something that actually we have to do something about on a regular basis. So loving kindness is a direct translation of the Pali word metta. Metta being also translated sometimes as goodwill, as in peace on earth, goodwill to all men. That classic quote from the Bible. It's an open-hearted energy. And this is opposed to, directly opposed to, ill will, or wishing that individuals or groups of people or even whole nations suffer. That's ill will. Goodwill, metta, loving kindness is the opposite. This also isn't love in the sort of popular culture sense of the word love. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about loving kindness. This is kindness with a flavor of love attached to it, a sweetness to it in a way. And on the surface, it seems like, well, geez, that's something of course I'm like that. Right? Of course I'm full of loving kindness. We all like to think that we're good people. And we don't have a problem in this area. But the truth is, we all do. We all have reactive mental patterns that cause us to react, to have thoughts of ill will or actions of ill will towards certain people, a particular person perhaps, or in certain situations, or against certain groups of people, certain races, certain colors, certain who knows, sexes, sexual orientations, pick your thing that you're going to be against. We all have that energy if we're not careful. And this leads us to have to using words and even expressing in action ill will. And that ill will causes suffering in the world, both for us and for everyone else. And so if we acknowledge that that's true, and we also acknowledge that all the practice we've been talking about up till now is leading us towards a place where that doesn't occur so much, and hopefully in the end doesn't occur at all. What can we do about this? What can we do about these reactive patterns of mind that lead us, often quite unconsciously, to speak and act in ways that are unwholesome, that are filled with ill will? And so loving kindness is both, like I said, the end product of the practice, but also something we have to cultivate, something we have to practice, something we have to do something about. In the Metta Sutta, which is the Buddha's teaching, primary teaching on this particular topic, starts, the very first line is this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. So first of all, this is what should be done. It's not something that should be thought about or contemplated. It's something that should be done. And it has to be done by one who is skilled in goodness. So skilled implies practice. Skilled implies that we actually are consciously practicing loving kindness. And so how can we practice something so elusive? There's this like, it's like almost like this esoteric idea, like being kind to everyone, being having thoughts of loving kindness towards all beings. How do we do that? It's sort of elusive. And once again, I want to go to the Metta Sutta and talk about how much, that this takes a lot of energy. This is where, remember way back there a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about effort, about energy, about how important that was. This takes a lot of effort. And how much effort? This is, once again, a quote from the Sutta. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. So in other words, as intensely, as much as you possibly can, and think about what those words describe. And if you have had a difficult time with your mother, replace the word mother with another word that is someone that you have respect for, and that would be okay. The Buddha wouldn't care. But it's like protects with her life, her child, her only child. That's how much energy we have to put into this practice. And then a bit further on in the sutta, the Buddha says, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. Well, think about it. Standing, walking, seated, lying down. Sort of covers everything. You know, maybe these days the Buddha would say, or driving in your car or something like that. But basically, we're always in one of those four positions, standing, walking, seated, lying down. This is sort of Buddhist code, essentially, which basically means all the time, without exception, all the time. In other places, the Buddha uses almost these same words, and then he adds, or in any other position you might find yourself, just to make sure, no excuses. You can't sort of, well, I'm sort of half sitting and half standing, so it doesn't count, Sorry. But always, so we have to practice this very intently all the time. Wow, that's a lot. And as a practice itself, I don't know, some of you may not be familiar with the actual practice of metta, and there are lots of different ways. And the way I'm familiar with is we use a set of phrases that you repeat over and over and over again. And you either bring a particular person into the mind, or you bring a group of people, or all beings, or there's lots of different phrases you can use. But you use the following. Typically, we use something like this. You visualize this person in the mind. You sort of open your heart as wide as you can. You sort of make a connection to that person as much as you can by having this visualization and perhaps a memory of them or thoughts of their positive, wholesome attributes. And then you repeat the phrases, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. And basically, if you think about what those four phrases say, you're basically saying, may you have absolutely the best conditions possible for practice. Think about it. If you always felt safe, happy, healthy, or as healthy as you can be, and live with ease means have no worries about financial situation or having a roof overhead or three square meals, like having a life that's the basics are already all taken care of. If you had that, how easy it would be to practice. And that's what you're wishing for with this other person, or these other people, or all beings. So in a sense, You're by repeating these phrases over and over and over again. This is a meditative practice. You've now chosen your meditative object to be these four phrases. And so now you're going to concentrate on just repeating these phrases over and over again. You're literally filling your mind with thoughts of loving kindness. And the beauty of the mind is that if it's full of thoughts of loving kindness, it can't be full of thoughts of ill will. That mind is a linear processor. So you can only do one thing at a time and does one thing and then the next and the next. And the more you have thoughts of loving kindness, the more you fill your heart and mind with thoughts of loving kindness, the less space there is, the less time there is for thoughts of ill will. It's really that simple. It's like you're just replacing and weakening those reactive patterns of ill will with patterns of goodwill, of loving kindness. And eventually, over time, as you practice this way, it becomes your normal reaction. When you encounter another being in whatever situation or a group of people or a situation, your first reaction is one of loving kindness. And the key word that we have to remember, and this is a word the Buddha uses three or four times in the sutta, he talks about basically all beings without exception. You can't leave anyone out. It can't be, well, I can have loving kindness for all those people except, you know, those Seattle Seahawks fans. Ugh, you know, I'm a Broncos fan. I just can't feel, you know, whatever. Pick your thing that you might object to, right? Could be Republicans. It could be Democrats. It could be, who knows? We won't have trouble finding things we object to if we start looking. And so to actually be able to have a heart full of loving kindness that you direct towards all beings without exception, this is a definition of an enlightened being. This is what and how an enlightened being lives in the world. An enlightened being is one who lives in the world with a heart always full of loving kindness without exception. There's a great story about the Dalai Lama I love, where he's being interviewed on Oprah of all places. I mean, Dalai Lama would go any place, right? So he's being interviewed on Oprah. And Oprah asks him, you know, something like, you know, and what is it that annoys you? Like she's trying to, you know, get him some reaction about, you know, something he's not happy with. And he says, he sort of sits there for a minute and he thinks, he says, I really don't like mosquitoes that much. And that's it. And she's sort of like, and she's saying, and that's it? Just mosquitoes? He said, yeah, just mosquitoes. And she's like standing there with her mouth open. She's just like, can't believe that that's what he would say. But that, given the situation he's been in his life, where he had to flee his country and he's being persecuted and, you know, dissed and all kinds of horrible things said about him for many, many years. This is the worst he could come up with. Is I'm not too happy with mosquitoes. This is a being who's full of loving kindness. And for him, loving kindness, when you encounter suffering, compassion arises. And that's why compassion is such a huge thing for him. And actually in the Mahayana traditions in general, is that their emphasis is on compassion, but that's just taking that energy of loving kindness and expressing it towards people who are suffering. So that's loving kindness. Then the other of these two mind states, these are wholesome mind states, so I have to, that we arise that are part of this list of the 10 paramis. The last one is equanimity. And equanimity, in some senses, is the culmination of the practice. If you look at many lists, besides the 10 paramis, you'll see equanimity, you know, the seven factors of awakening. There's equanimity right at the last one. You know, the four Brahma Viharas. Oh, there's equanimity, the last of the four. It's like it's at the top of a lot of lists of the Buddha's wholesome quality lists. it's something he keeps coming back to in his teachings all the time. And so I want to sort of look at this. What is equanimity? And I want to start, this is a quote by Sharon Salzberg from her book, Loving Kindness. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. I'm going to read that again because it's so wonderful. Equanimity is the spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. And I really like this definition for several reasons. I want to sort of take it apart, unpack it a little bit. And I want, right at the very beginning, she says, equanimity is a spacious stillness. So your mind is still, but spacious. It's open to whatever's coming. It isn't still, but zoned out. It isn't still, but shut down. This is someone who is wide awake. And totally tuned in with an open heart. And it's like there's this room for everything that arises. There's nothing that's going to arise, nothing that's going to happen, nothing that someone's going to say or something that I'm going to experience or something that's going to happen in the world around me that's going to throw me out of this space of equanimity. Nothing is rejected. Here's another definition I also like that has some sort of emphasis in this area. This is by someone named Rebecca Bradshaw. Equanimity is a continuous accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart-mind can connect with this world and all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. I think that last sentence is great. Our capacity to flow with the river of change. Like we're not pushing against the river. We're not pushing against anything. We're flowing with the river of change. Another aspect of Sharon's definition, I think, is also significant. She uses the phrase radiant calm. So not only is your mind focused and still, not only is your heart open, but you're radiant, which means that the energy that you're experiencing is flowing out into the world around you. It's not just for you, it's something that you radiate into the world, literally. Think what that's like to be around someone like that who actually radiates that calm energy. I have some small experience with this. It's not even in my notes, but I thought it struck me I should tell you this story of what happened to me once. This is one of my retreat stories, what can I tell you? So I'm on retreat, and this is with my teacher, Guy Armstrong. And the night before, he'd given a talk about gratitude practice. And he basically said, you know, he encouraged people how important gratitude was and as a wholesome mind state. And he suggested that what people do if they want to explore this is just take a sheet of paper and just write down all the things they're grateful for. Just write down, write down, write down, write down. And on this particular retreat, this is a retreat like with, you know, 80 or 90 people, there was this one woman I noticed, you know, you notice people who just looked really, really unhappy. Just, you know, how some people, their affect is like, they're just like, her shoulders were hunched in and she was looking down and she had a sad look on her face. She just like, it was sad, you know, and I sort of noticed that. So anyhow, the next morning at the question time there, she comes into the hall and she's all sort of like full of energy and like she's really looking really great. And during the question time, she raises her hand and Guy says, you know, go ahead, ask your question. And she says, I started writing down things that I'm grateful for. I've written down 5 pages of things. Am I overdoing this? That was her basic question. And Guy just looked straight at her and he just said 2 words. He said, keep going. But the way he said it, you could just feel that equanimity, the stillness of mind, and that loving kindness flow out of him into the room. I mean, I was sitting and I literally almost fell off my chair. I was just like blown back by the energy of that, just those 2 words. And she was just like, you know, she was lit up like a candle. She was like this. So it's a very powerful thing to have, be around people who are have this reading come, or to offer that to the world. And this is why I always argue against people who say, oh, this meditation stuff is fine, but it's kind of selfish and personal and, you know, no. Think of what it's like if there's more people who are radiantly calm in the world, what the world would be like if we had more people like that. This is something you can really offer the world. All of us can offer this, can give this energy to the world. That's part of why I think practice is so important and part of why I practice. Finally, there's another phrase here. It says, to be fully present with the different changing experiences. To be fully present with all the different changing experiences. I think this is a great definition of not suffering. Think about it. Why do we suffer? We suffer because we push, we grasp and try and hold on to things that we want to keep. And we push away things that we don't want. That's the opposite of being fully present with, because things are always changing. Yeah. We get caught in this space of wanting to keep things we like and wanting not to have the things we don't like, trying to push them away. Desire and aversion, right? And that means we're not flowing with the river of change, to go back to Rebecca Bradshaw's phrase. It's the opposite of that. And it's like, with equanimity, we start to understand that everything is impermanent, constantly changing. If you are equanimous, if you're truly equanimous, you're in a wholesome mind state where suffering does not exist. Wow. Think of that. This is like so obvious, but so difficult to grasp and to then practice. We have to also pay attention to one other thing about equanimity, and that's that any of you who are readers of texts and readers of translations of various sorts, and particularly in the, and I've seen this more in the yoga texts where these same things are talked about. The word equanimity in Pali is upekkha, in Sanskrit it's upeksham. And often you see this translated as indifference, which is, I must say, sadly incorrect. Indifference externally on the outside sort of looks like equanimity, right? It's like the person's very calm, and there's like, but they're not engaged. There's not any sense of connection to the world. In fact, it's a rejection of the world. It's, I don't care. That's not equanimity. It looks, has that external glow, perhaps, that we might think of it's equanimity, but it's not at all. In fact, it's the opposite. This is an unwholesome mind state, indifference. It masquerades as equanimity. Equanimity is infused with loving kindness. These two feed back and forth each other. You know, equanimity allows you to stay with a heart open in the midst of suffering. And loving kindness feeds into and creates more equanimity. Because equanimity, that open-heartedness of equanimity, is really a sense of being open to all beings, no matter what. Being open to whatever is arising from whatever being you encounter. So I've been talking this mainly from a practice point of view, but what about from our daily life? And I want to just read a little bit from Joseph Goldstein's book here. And this is in a section where he's actually talking about equanimity. The first way we experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Each of us is touched by what are called the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are the endlessly changing conditions of pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. With equanimity, when equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our lives. So these are the famous, another famous Buddhist list, the eight vicissitudes. You see this in various suttas. I want to talk a little bit of this because this is, gives us a sense of what we're, maybe a better sense of what equanimity really means. First of these, this first pair is gain and loss. Often we think about this in terms of financial or physical, getting stuff, right? But it's also very relevant to our practice. You know, we have a good sit. You know, have you ever had that thought? Oh, that was a good sit. And then we think somehow we've gained something. Oh, I finally got this figured out a little bit. I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I've gained. And then the next sit or the next day or the next week, what do you have? You have a bad sit. You know, one of those sits where you sit down and your mind's like a train wreck for the entire sitting period. And you're grumpy because your mind's like a train wreck. And we sort of feel like we've lost something, that we've, maybe even that we've done something wrong. This is just the play of gain and loss in our minds. There was nothing to lose and nothing to gain. These were just experiences we had where sometimes we have one experience when we're practicing and sometimes we have another. There's not the sense that there's something to lose or something to gain. It's just a mental flutter in our brain. It's not, has no actual truth in reality. Then we have praise and blame. And it's really easy in this world to get caught feeling good about praise and feeling bad about blame. And both of those, feeling good about the praise and bad about the blame, these are just reactions that create more sense of separate self. I'm good, I'm bad. I did great, I did poorly, because someone said something. This is just your mind creating more sense of self. This is the, not equanimous. Okay, it's like in if you have equanimity, whether someone praises you or blames you, doesn't make any difference. To remember, I had a teacher who's back in the 70s and 80s, an Indian teacher, and one of his favorite phrases in his teaching was, bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. It's like, no matter what, didn't make any difference. Then we have fame and disrepute. So this is like praise and blame on a larger scale. You know, these ideas that you're famous or that you're the opposite, you're a scoundrel, the disrepute, these are just thoughts in other people's minds. That's all they are. There's nothing more to them than the fact that they're thoughts in other people's minds. They don't mean anything more than someone has these thoughts. They're not real. They're not, in the sense that they should affect you in any way. And I'm not saying that, you know, if you've done something unwholesome and someone speaks to you about it, corrects you, that you should ignore what they're saying. That's different. But it's that when someone paints you into this box, like you're always like this, you're this bad person, or you're this wonderful, great person, either way, that's when we have to watch our minds. Finally, pleasure and pain. This cycle of pleasure and pain. We get some pleasure. You know, I had a nice walk this morning. It was very pleasant. But then you get some pain. You know, my calves were a little stiff afterwards. You know, it could be as simple as that. But it's like, basically, sometimes things are pleasant and sometimes things are unpleasant. They're painful even. This is just a cycle of life. It's like being a human being. There's nothing we can do about it. It's perfectly natural and it's not our fault. It's not our fault that we're experiencing something painful right now. It's just stuff happens. You know, you get COVID-19 because you happen to be standing in line in the store next to some guy who had it and you didn't know, and probably maybe he didn't know, but now you got that pain. This is just how things are. There's nothing like you didn't do anything to deserve this. It's just life. So these eight vicissitudes, we have to watch for them, these mental states arising. Gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. We have to watch for them as they arise and be able to see them and have that radiant calm about them. To be have that spacious stillness around them, so that they don't take on some big significant thing that gets us going. It's just what happened now. That's all. Just stuff. There is also a phrase that you might want to work with almost in a meditative way. Just as you can practice metta, you can practice equanimity. There's an actual equanimity phrase. And that phrase is, your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Or, to put it in the other way, my happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes. We can wish all we want for our own happiness or for the happiness of others, but we can't actually make anyone or ourselves. We can't make ourselves happy just by wishing. We actually have to act. We have to, you know, in our case, because we're practitioners, be serious about the practice. Struggle with it. Be difficult. And sometimes it's going to be painful, difficult. That's the nature of practice. Sometimes it's not going to be pleasant at all. But our happiness or unhappiness depends on our actions, not on our wishes. And it's a hard thing to take in about ourselves. It's even harder to take in when we shift that to think about our loved ones, people that we're really close to, our partners, our children, our parents, our siblings, close friends. We somehow think we can make them happy. And to be equanimous is to realize, no, you can't. Only they can make themselves happy. You can, with some effort, hopefully create the causes and conditions for your own happiness. But they have to do the same for theirs. As much as you would like to magically make them happy, you can't. It's really hard to take in. This is where equanimity often gets thrown under the bus. Oh, this is great, except, you know, oh, I got to take care of my mother or whatever, you know, thing it is that's got you. And this is where we have to start. This is one of the difficult place where we have to pay attention, is in this sense of it's our job to make other people happy. It's our job to make ourselves happy. And that's hard enough, as you all know. Yeah. And I'm not saying this doesn't mean you shouldn't do things, nice things for people. You know, that's fine. But don't expect them to be happy because you did it. That's the hard part. You know, it's a tricky place. And if the mind can be full of loving kindness, and if the mind can tend towards equanimity, then the practice starts to really shift. Yeah. Because initially the practice, we're dealing with the tumult of the mind, the chaos of all those stories I keep talking about, and blah, 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 blah. And we're just buffeted by that, and we're buffeted by the eight vicissitudes. And as we sort of gradually become more equanimous, the eight vicissitudes aren't affecting us. We have this sort of clear, calm, still mind. Then the practice becomes much more not about the content of the mind at all, but about the underlying patterns of the mind itself. We're starting to actually see how things really are. That being one definition of the practice, right? We experience the arising and passing away of everything. We see things are there. They're there for a while, then they're gone. And we see this over and over and over and over. And we do this without getting attached to anything or trying to push it away. so we're seeing this pattern of constantly things arise, they're there and they're gone. And because of that, we see the unreliability of anything as a source of true happiness. There's no thing that's going to work. They're all unsatisfactory. They're unreliable. Because everything is constantly changing. So no matter what we try and hold on to, no what we try and make to be our anchor, it's going to be gone. It's going to be gone in a second or a day or a year or a month or a year, but who knows? It's going to be gone. And because, and then even underneath that, and this is the most difficult part, we start to see that there's no solid self to be happy in the first place. It's tricky. And this one I'm struggling with myself a lot, right? So it's not like I can give you great words of wisdom. But that's, it's something we have to understand from the very beginning of the practice, that the sense of a separate self is often the greatest cause of our suffering. Because we spend so much energy trying to maintain this separate self, this image of ourselves as being separate. All the energy we put into that causes a lot of problems, both for ourselves and for others. So I have two pieces of poetry. My last thing in the series, I have to have two pieces of poetry, right? So I'm going to start with Dana Fald's. I've read a lot of, but this is a, I think, an equanimity poem, actually. It's called Remember This. Remember that one definition of the word sati, which is usually translated as mindfulness, means remembering. Remember this. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. So, over the last 5 weeks, we've looked at these 10 paramis, these 10 perfections of the heart. Let's just very briefly go through them. We started with generosity and virtue. How we live in the world, how we interact in the world, has to be the basis, the sound foundation for everything else. And generosity and virtue are the keys to that. Then we had renunciation and wisdom. Once we've got our life in order in the world, then we start looking at the life and going, well, what can I let go of here? What do I not need to cling to? What do I not need to do anymore? So that I'll have more time for practice. And then by devoting that time to practice, wisdom starts to arise. We start to understand more clearly how important the practice is. And then we're encouraged to apply more effort because we start to see things actually changing. But at the same time that we apply more effort, we have to be patient. We can't sort of expect things to magically change. This patience is absolutely necessary. This is This is a long-term, lifelong project. Then comes truthfulness and resolve. Truthfulness here, remember, was about being honest with ourselves, being honest with the fact that we're not perfect, and being okay with the fact that we're not perfect, and being honest when we see those imperfections arise in our mind or in our actions or in our words. And then try to skillfully change that and take that firm resolve to actually stick with this no matter what, to really consciously choose to make this the center post of your entire life. That's resolve. Yes, I'm going to do this. And then loving kindness and equanimity start to arise. More and more in our lives, what we experience is these wholesome mind states of loving kindness and equanimity, and we can consciously cultivate them to make them even more stronger. And over time, so they tell me, loving kindness and equanimity become how you react in the world all the time. It becomes, that's what an enlightened being is. An enlightened being is one who is always full of loving kindness and is always equanimous. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But the beauty of this practice is it's a process. It's like, well, if I'm not, and we don't want to get caught in, well, I'll never be that way. Well, you can move towards that. You can see how these practices over time, we change. We actually change how we are in, how we're reacting to others in the world and how we're reacting to things that arise. That's what's important. It's a process, and the process takes time and energy, patience, effort, being honest with ourselves. So that's the 10 paramis. I want to read one other thing here. This is the final section of a long poem by Mary Oliver. It's called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. This is just the final section. This says it all. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I have gone out of my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment for somehow or another. And I have become a child of clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. So that's all I really have to say.